We're going to start the meeting, even though we don't have a quorum. And I went to a meeting last night to learn how to be a chair. And that's what they told us. So the meeting won't officially start now, but it is past the time to start the meeting, so we will start. And today we're hearing from the Department of Health on two different things. One, a budget overview, and secondly, an update on the healthcare reform part of the bill that we passed this past year. So if there's somebody from the Department of Health, and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Scott Light. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Health. And with me today is Craig Akam, who's the Chief Financial Officer for the department. Commissioner Magan sends her regrets. She was unable to attend today. She's out of town, but wanted to express her regrets and her admiration for the chair and his work in health reform and all the other things that he has done. I want to thank the committee for inviting us to provide an overview of the Minnesota Department of Health and our activities. Realize that not all of the department's activities are under the purview or jurisdiction of this committee, but we are going to provide an overview of the full department just so you have some context of the work that we do globally. I'll start by providing a brief description of public health and how it differs from healthcare delivery. Then I'll describe some of the important areas of work that the Minnesota Department of Health does, and then I'll conclude with a brief summary of funding, where it comes from, and then where it goes. For starters, I'd like to point out a few issues that have been in the news which demonstrate the work that we do. As members have probably heard, we recently announced that we had found a link between the King Nut brand of peanut butter and cases of salmonella here in Minnesota. This was a national issue, but it was a case that was actually broken by our Minnesota Department of Health. Our department has also been in the news for investigations we've conducted into cases of abuse occurring in nursing homes, work that we've done documenting declines in teen smoking, Work that we've done documenting adverse events in Minnesota's hospitals, and you periodically see flu updates from the department. It's just a demonstration of the types of work that we do that shows up in the news. We do appreciate the opportunity to talk about the ways in which we fulfill our mission to protect, maintain, and improve the health of Minnesotans. We do that via a shared role with both local government through state law, as well as our federal partners such as the CDC. As an agency, we embrace the values of integrity, collaboration, respect, science, and accountability as guiding values for our work. A question that frequently comes up is, how does public health differ from healthcare delivery? And there is an important distinction between healthcare and public health. Healthcare is primarily focused on addressing an individual's health issues, diagnosis, treatment, and recovery. And the medical system does a great job of addressing individual health needs, especially here in Minnesota. Public health applies to groups or communities, both geographic and based on shared characteristics. It also focuses on preventing problems before they occur and become more serious. As an example, think about smoking. If I'm a smoker, a doctor might prescribe a patch or medication to help an individual stop smoking. Public health implements policies and programs, such as the Freedom to Breathe Act, That help the entire population to avoid the health risks of exposure to cigarette smoke. Both are necessary implementations, but they simply have a focus on either the individual or, in public health case, the entire community. The National Institutes of Health, which is part of the Federal United Health, the Federal Health and Human Services, has identified three core functions of public health, and you'll see examples of these core functions as we move through today's presentation. The first is assessing the public's health. What are the health trends and changes over time, and who's affected? Examples of data that we use to look at this include birth and death records, disease reports, and things such as the behavior risk factor surveillance system. A second area of a core public health function is to promote policies. These might be laws or things like education or guidelines. An example would be which vaccinations should children receive and at what ages. And then finally, a core public health function is to assure effectiveness. Did we succeed in improving the population's health? When we've assessed the problem and promoted policies, did the policies and the assessment result in better health across the population? An example that I could use here would be the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative at the department. In that case, we assessed that there were large differences in infant mortality, immunization rates, and other things across populations of color in the white population in Minnesota. The initiative itself promoted the policies of building capacity at the local level to be able to address these issues with clear goals for what those reductions in disparities should be. And then we assured effectiveness by examining how well we're doing to eliminate those disparities. It's just an example of how the core public health functions are applied to a given program. This slide highlights that we've had huge changes in average life expectancy over the last 100 years, an increase of over 30 years that occurred during the 20th century. The CDC, one of our key national partners, has estimated that 25 of the 30 years of life gained in the 20th century were the result of public health accomplishments, such as immunizations, food safety, sanitation, and the control of infectious diseases. I would quiz you on what the big dip is in 1918, but I know the chair already knows the answer to that question, so I'll
really explain it. I always love that.
Mr. Chair, that was the 1918 influenza pandemic. More than 10,000 Minnesotans died that winter as a result of the flu pandemic. Estimates are that if the impact of a worst-case pandemic flu happened today, we'd have about 33,000 deaths and about 1.5 million sick people here in Minnesota alone. So it's a serious issue. It was a serious issue in 1918. It continues to be a serious issue.
And Commissioner Leitz, I just read in the paper, I think yesterday, that three people have died in China because of the bird flu. So it may be coming back again.
It's an issue that continues to be with us, Mr. Chair. Partially because of our strong public health system, Minnesota does consistently rank as one of the healthiest states in the nation. Now, we've ranked in the top five healthiest states since 1990, and that high ranking is partly due to Minnesota's strong commitment to public health. This past year was the first time that Minnesota wasn't ranked first or second. We actually slipped to fourth this past year in our national rankings. That was due to some slipping in some of our statistics, including things like geographic disparities that we do continue to need to address, and some slight improvements in the states ahead of us, but the report actually pointed out an overall very sobering fact that the nation's health in general has stagnated over the past several years. There really are six key areas of public health responsibility: assuring a strong public health system, promoting healthy communities and eliminating health disparities, preventing the spread of infectious disease, making environments safe and healthy, preparing for disasters and emergencies, and helping all people get quality health care services. And I'm going to give you some examples of the work that we do in each of these areas. Minnesota's public health system is known as one of the best in the country, and it's really built on a strong partnership between the Minnesota Department of Health and our local public health agencies and tribal governments. The 1976 Community Health Services Act established a framework and reorganized several hundred of the local public health agencies into what is now 53 county and city health departments that cover the entire state. And we share responsibilities with tribal governments and those local public health agencies in acting together to identify and address public health issues. We provide grants under the local public health grant program to those local entities and tribal government, and then funds are leveraged at the local level as well. The Minnesota Department of Health's Office of the State Registrar registers all births and deaths in Minnesota through a secure centralized electronic system. Together with funeral homes, medical examiners, and coroner's offices, hospitals, and physicians throughout the state, the OSR registers over 75,000 births and 38,000 deaths, and we issue over 750,000 birth and death certificates. We're currently in the process of re-engineering our state vital record system. This is to ensure that we keep pace with the latest in secure technology. That's essential because this mission-critical system has to prevent unauthorized access to Minnesotans' most fundamental identity documents, their birth and death certificates. We want to make sure that those documents are held securely and issued accurately. And this year, thanks to a lean processing process that we went through, the Minnesota Department of Health reduced the time it takes to process requests for duplicate birth certificates by more than 80%, from 6 days to less than one. We also work to promote healthy communities and eliminate health disparities. The Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative is an important initiative towards achieving that end. As a result of the grants that occur under this program, community-based capacity and leadership have strengthened within the communities of color and American Indians in Minnesota. We've seen rates of infant mortality, immunization, diabetes, cardiovascular health among populations of color and American Indians improve, but there's a lot of work still to be done. As we know that the population in Minnesota is growing more diverse, we realize that the program itself has to also evolve. So we're going to be building upon capacities gained from working with individual and communities to broaden the HDI scope to encompass more policy and systems approaches to ensure that we're not only building capacity at the local level, but that we're getting upstream to get at some of the root causes of leading disparities in health outcomes for people. We also promote healthy communities through our Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC program that provides a healthy start for pregnant women, infants, and kids up through age 5 through nutritional assessment and key nutritious foods. WIC is providing services to almost 145,000 Minnesota mothers and children. It's an important gateway program for other health intervention efforts, connecting high-risk vulnerable populations to needed services throughout Minnesota. We also do a lot of work around the issue of chronic disease. As this committee knows, much of our healthcare spending and healthcare costs is driven by people in Minnesota who are chronically ill. We know that about 70 Minnesotans die every day from chronic disease, and that 7 out of 10 Americans who die each year die from a chronic disease. We estimate that 40% of annual premature death could be prevented if we could alter environmental conditions, social inequities, and behavioral choices. As Commissioner Magans has often said about chronic disease, we need to do a better job of preventing us from sitting, smoking, and supersizing to ensure that we get better outcomes for our population. I'm now going to take you through a set of slides that demonstrates one aspect of why we have increasing chronic disease.
Mr. Lights, if I could interrupt just for a minute, we now have a quorum, so I will call the meeting to order. And Representative Emmer spent the first 10 minutes reading the minutes. And
yes, I did, Mr. Chair, and I have a few changes. No, I make the motion.
So, Representative Emmer has moved the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Emmer. And Commissioner Light, continue on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm taking through a series of slides that demonstrate one element that links very closely to chronic disease, and that's the epidemic of obesity. We know that obesity is linked to many chronic diseases such as diabetes, heart disease, and other things. The data that I'm going to take you through is going to be a map of the United States over the last 20 years that demonstrates it'll be clear whether we become thinner or heavier during that time period, let me say. But it'll be a relatively brief series of slides.
Keep your eye on Minnesota.
The legend here, the lighter that we are, the lighter that the map is initially, the lighter we are, and the darker that we are, the heavier we are. And some new colors will be introduced as we get heavier over time. So this is 1985. 1986, 7, 8. By 1990, we've introduced a new dark blue color. We have a new color introduced, which is over 20% of the population. That's the tan color being obese. This is obesity among U.S. adults. And now red has been introduced to the chart. That's not the last red you're going to see either. By 2004, so Mr. Chair, by 2007, you see that Minnesota, which was once a light blue state, is now a red state. If you will go back to 1997,
no political
commentary. No political commentary. That's pretty good. There really isn't anything. If you go back to 1997, there wasn't any red on this map. It was all blue or tan. We've introduced a darker shade of red in the south, and Minnesota itself is 25 to 29% of the population being obese. And in fact,
Representative Emmer, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lease. You've got 5'4" and 30 pounds overweight. For a person, average person of 5'4", what would be the base weight?
of a normal weight.
Okay.
Is that Mr. Chair?
I want to do the math.
110, 115, Mr. Chair, Representative M, or something of that nature. Essentially, it's measured by the BMI, the body mass index, which changes depending on the... an example would be approximately 30 pounds overweight for a 5'4" person. So, Mr. Chair, we estimate that if we had managed to maintain our level of obesity that we had in 1995, our healthcare system probably would have saved around $860 million just in Minnesota alone by the prevention of chronic diseases related to obesity. It has a real effect. And because of that, one of the parts of the health reform bill that was passed by the legislature this year was the State Health Improvement Program. We will be focusing on policy systems and environmental changes through that program to drive down rates of obesity and tobacco use in Minnesota. That will be done by awarding grants to community health boards and tribal governments beginning in July 1st of 2009.
Commissioner Lights, when are their applications due? Is it this month?
Mr. Chair, we're working on the request for proposals for those that I believe is due to go out on in the early part of February 8th or thereabouts, and then there'll be a time period for people to apply after that. Grants will be, as I said, we want to be ready to have grants go out in July of 2009.
And that's, for members that don't know, that's $47 million over a two-year period out of the Health Care Access Fund.
Mr. Chair, we do know that our own choices also help determine our health status, and so we strive to provide information and encouragement to help Minnesotans make healthy choices. This is a couple examples of how we do that through the State Health Department. The first the left-hand side is Work Well, Healthy Minnesota Workplace Toolkit that we recently created for employers across Minnesota. This toolkit was developed to guide employers through designing, implementing, and evaluating worksite wellness initiatives. And then on the other side, the Cover Your Cough campaign is a poster that you'll most likely find in virtually every hospital and clinic in the state. It's a award-winning poster that we developed here a few years ago that's now being used across the country and even abroad with a very simple but effective message, cover your cough, to prevent the spread of germs. The newborn screening program is available to all of the approximately 73,000 babies born in Minnesota. Soon after birth, a small sample of blood is tested for 53 congenital and inherited diseases that can be life-threatening or severely debilitating if not detected. About 140 children each year are saved from mental retardation, severe disability, or even death because of testing through this program. A third area, and actually, can I have a page, please? Something I like to pass around. Thank you. What I'm passing around actually is just I'm going to talk a little bit about the spread of infectious disease. Part of the role that we play at the department is educating both the public and others about things in general. But what we're demonstrating on them is the difference between wood ticks and deer ticks. And so what I'm passing around on the left is a wood tick. And on the right are deer ticks at different stages of development. And they have very different implications for people. So thank you very much. We also work at the department to prevent the spread of infectious disease through around-the-clock monitoring for infectious diseases. Our epidemiologists and laboratory workers work together to monitor disease reports and lab specimens to quickly identify disease outbreaks. MDA scientists were responsible for determining, for example, that the cause of an outbreak of salmonella last year was actually due to peppers, not tomatoes, as everyone initially thought it was. And as I mentioned earlier, we are also actively and have been investigating the current salmonella outbreak, which we've linked to peanut butter through the King Nut Company.
And Commissioner Lights, you might want to explain why Minnesota got that first, and just because they identified it was people that were in institutional settings that were most likely to get this?
On peanut butter one, Mr. Chair? Yes, we did identify that in institutional nursing home settings that there were some cases of salmonella that we were able to link back to the peanut butter that was used in that facility. The rates of invasive pneumococcal disease, including meningitis, used to be the highest among young children. a new pneumococcal vaccine was introduced and licensed in 2000, and it protects against most types of pneumococcus that cause these serious infections. Through education and coordination with healthcare providers, the number of cases in children under the age of 5 has been drastically reduced, as shown in the chart, from an average of around 200 cases per year in 1997 through 1999 to about 50 cases more recently. So we've had a lot of impact in helping to reduce the incidence of that particular illness through vaccination. A fourth area is making the environment safe and healthy. I'd like to highlight just a few environmental health issues. In 2006, Minnesota was recognized by the National Groundwater Association for sealing more than 200,000 wells cumulatively. We seal more abandoned wells to prevent groundwater contamination than all other states combined. To date, over 230,000 wells have been sealed. And this is important because of our dependency. About 70% of Minnesotans rely on groundwater as their primary source of drinking water. We also collect and analyze more than 150,000 drinking water samples each year to assure that the public receives safe drinking water. And we're working with restaurant managers to develop food safety protocols and systems, not just inspections, to protect food safety. There are more than 20,000 licensed establishments in Minnesota. Unfortunately, in spite of those efforts, chemicals have been released into the air, water, and the soil. And so we work very closely with Minnesota communities, with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Agriculture to investigate and understand risks associated with chemical exposure and ultimately to assist in cleaning up, setting up clean up standards for contaminated areas. In addition, floods and tornadoes are a fact of life in Minnesota, and the Health Department works quickly to provide services such as testing well water for contamination, that's a free service, and provide advice about molds and food safety and immunizations for things such as tetanus. Flooding occurs almost yearly in Minnesota, and we work with local communities to assist them in safeguarding the public's health by making sure that the well water test kits are ready and water samples are quickly analyzed. We also do investigations into novel diseases, working closely with our partners. Last year, there was an outbreak of a very unusual neurological illness that some of you probably remember from the news. And this was detected among workers at a swine processing plant in southern Minnesota. The condition was named progressive inflammatory neuropathy, or PIN. In close collaboration from plant management and work groups, MDH investigated the cause of this novel debilitating disease. The use of compressed air to remove swine brain resulting in aerosolization of brain material was identified as the cause of the illness. We worked clearly with all the partners that you see on the chart here, the CDC, the USDA, Indiana State Department of Health, and others. It was truly a team effort to do this work into a very, very rare and very, very novel disease. And following our investigation and recommendation that the use of compressed air to remove swine brains be discontinued, no additional cases of this disease have been detected. A fifth area is preparing for disasters and emergencies. In May of 2007, more than 2,000 people in Slayton, Minnesota received immune globulin following a hepatitis A outbreak at a restaurant that sickened 8 people, one of whom required a liver transplant and subsequently died. This highlights the close relationship that we have with local public health that I mentioned earlier. The investigation and clinics combined the efforts of state and local health departments. Finding outbreaks early and preventing further cases means fewer people get sick and needing more expensive healthcare services. A major activity following September 11, 2001 has been the state and local public health department preparedness. Federal funding supports 24/7 communication tools, training and emergency response activities, planning, and tabletop exercises. This picture shows our Departmental Operations Center, where staff are coordinating the local and state activities during the Republican National Convention that occurred in St. Paul. A new focus since September 11th has been the development of healthcare and hospital emergency plans and responsibilities. Hospitals have joined together with leadership from MDH and federal funding to develop plans to care for large numbers of injured or ill persons, even in non-traditional settings. We really learned the value of this planning for the disasters through the response to the 35W bridge collapse, in which the same hospitals who participated in this exercise were responsible for rapidly assessing and caring for the surge of patients that occurred during that tragedy. The sixth and final area is to help all people get quality health services. This chart shows how healthcare cost growth in Minnesota has outpaced some of the key other economic measures over time. It's just one example of the types of information that we provide to lawmakers and other policymakers and the statistics that are available through the Minnesota Department of Health. You've certainly seen presentations from Julie Sonier in the Health Economics Program on issues such as this, and we provide information such as information on health insurance, total healthcare spending, healthcare system capacity, reporting on adverse hospital events, best practices and technical support around advancing e-health in Minnesota, and information on the policy decisions and the impact of those decisions on rural health and safety net providers. MDH is also responsible for implementing many of the healthcare reforms that the legislature passed in 2008. These reforms came from recommendations of the Governor's Healthcare Transformation Task Force and the Legislative Commission on Healthcare Access. And so in addition to providing staff support for these decision-making processes, Minnesota is currently working to implement a wide range of reforms on an aggressive time schedule. Many of these reforms are complicated, yet we are on, as you'll see later, we are on a track to implement these reforms under the timelines given to us. We know we'll be talking about those a little bit later on, but the reforms include things such as the statewide health improvement program I mentioned earlier, a system to certify healthcare homes along with care coordination payments, the implementation of baskets of care, which will provide bundled payments for groups of healthcare services that are commonly provided for a given health condition, expanded quality reporting and a quality incentive payment system, and a system of provider peer grouping.
Representative Sloan, or Galvey, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question when you talk about quality and cost of health care, and it was related to the quality health care services, the cumulative health care cost growth. Do you mean health care or do you mean health insurance? For instance, a private pay, does this address the private pay or does this address people who pay through an insurance program?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the chart here actually illustrates, this is healthcare cost growth at health plans. So this is how much is being paid in claims. But it is cumulative of both the health plan's responsibility as well as the subscriber's responsibility. So it takes into account things such as shifting of co-pays and deductibles that have increased over some period of time.
And as a follow-up, then, thank you, Mr. Chair, do we have a chart that shows the actual cost of actual health care if someone was private pay and not going through an insurance plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have that information. I don't have it with me or on the top of my head, but we do have that information. I'd be happy to provide that to the committee.
I would like to see that. Thank you.
I just would say the dollar amount is over $30 billion in Minnesota per year.
Health
insurance. Spending on health care.
Mr. Chair, we also
Mr. Chair, where does that number come from?
Well, it's come from the Department of Health previously.
But is there some place where we can get that number, where it's we can actually see what its calculation, how it's been figured?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, absolutely. We have various reports that we'd be happy to provide to the committee that have that detail.
Well, I all the stuff that I have to sit through, but I want to be able to see $30 billion and then work backwards. You got something like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we certainly do.
Great, thanks.
Mr. Chair, almost 700,000 Minnesotans received care during the year from a nursing home or a hospital. We inspect over 1,000 licensed and certified healthcare facilities annually. We receive over 1,600 complaints about care in hospitals and nursing homes that we investigate 400 to 500 of those complaints by on-site visits. We work with the facilities to correct problems that exist and where necessary issue correction orders to ensure that the safety of and care for the residents. We've also been working diligently on improving how we monitor and assure quality care in long-term care facilities. In 2006, we released our first ever nursing home report card. This report card shows how Minnesota nursing homes scored on 7 quality measures. But we've also been working diligently to improve the transparency and consistency of our nursing home surveys across the state to ensure that when we go in to inspect the facility, it's being done in a transparent manner and in a manner that's consistent regardless of where that facility might be located in Minnesota. Our Office of Rural Health and Primary Care provides a forum for addressing rural health issues across Minnesota. The office distributes grants to maintain and improve health, rural health infrastructure and workforce. And it helps coordinate discussions about and assist in developing policy directions for issues such as workforce shortage, access to certain types of providers, facilities, and technologies. Finally, the office administers the statewide trauma system, which aims to ensure that severely injured people are properly transported and treated appropriately to the severity of injury. Last month, Fairview Southdale Hospital in Edina and Riverwood Healthcare Center in Aitkin became the first two hospitals in Minnesota to be designated as Level 3 trauma hospitals under this new system. Our current priorities as an agency strategically are ensuring that we continue to have a strong basis of prevention, that we are protected from public health threats, and that we successfully implement and continue to move forward on the issue of health care reform. And then briefly, Mr. Chair, where our funding comes from. As you can see from the pie chart here, of the approximately $1 billion that we will have in our budget in the next biennium, approximately 40% of that is from federal funds. The next largest source of money is the Merck funds that flow, including tobacco, a cigarette tax dedication, about 18%. General funds for the department are about 14%. And you can see the remainder of our budget is made up of appropriations from the Healthcare Access Fund, the State Government Special Revenue Fund, the Miscellaneous Special Revenue Fund, and TANF funds. The majority of our funds, in terms of where the money goes, are given out in grants to local units of government, community-based organizations, tribal governments, and educational institutions. Only about 39% of our funding actually supports MDH-based operations or activities. We have a website that offers a wealth of information. Encourage members and members of the audience to visit if you're looking for information. We have more than 30,000 pages of information with a lot of hits. Topics include diseases and conditions, health statistics and data, and people in the environment. We have much. We've worked very, very hard to get as much information as possible in an understandable way out on the web, so it's easily accessible for the public.
Representative Anzalk has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you go back and put up the slide where you break down? Yeah. The other one.
The other one?
Of the smaller amount of the two, the amount that is within the agency itself, do you have either a percentage or a dollar figure which relates to a direct services provided by the state agency itself, as opposed to direct services provided by your partners at the local level?
Mr. Chair, Representative, just so I understand your question, when you say direct services, do you mean direct aid, direct payments to individuals?
Direct services would be services directly provided to Minnesota citizens rather than services or dollars that are consumed by studies, technical assistance, other sorts of ancillary services, all equally important. But I'm trying to get an idea of direct services to Minnesota citizens in the public health system.
As an example, although I suppose you charge them for it, you inspect nursing homes for quality activities. So that would be a direct thing that you do.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm happy to go into more depth in the budget presentation, but
okay.
But I think the answer to your question will be forthcoming.
Thank you.
Commissioner. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I know we covered a lot of ground in the things that we've gone through here, but I wanted to, before I do that, just finally extend an invitation to the committee and to anyone who'd be interested to visit us in our office building in our state of the, and we'd be happy to give you a tour of our state of the art laboratory. It's about a block and a half from the Capitol building, and you're certainly welcome to visit. And we would very much be honored by that by the visit if you so chose.
It'd be a nice walk today. I'm not sure about tomorrow.
Or 2 weeks ago, Mr. Chair. We have covered a lot of ground here, but I'd like to leave you with just a couple closing points on this broad overview of the department. We do say that public health is one of the best investments government can make because of the focus on preventing problems before they become either human or economic losses. We take a lot of pride in Minnesota in ranking high on a lot of things, including being a very healthy state, and thanks in part to the past support the legislature has provided to us. But we know that we face a lot of challenges ahead to continue that trend, to ensure we continue to be a very healthy state and to reach out to people in Minnesota as Minnesota becomes an increasingly diverse state. So with that, Mr. Chair, as always, staff at the department is available throughout session to answer any questions. I'll provide whatever technical assistance that you might need to advance your work here in the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Commissioner Lake? Thank you, Commissioner.
Great. Well, Mr. Chair, with that, maybe I'll just launch into kind of a quick overview of the budget that goes along with the department overview that Assistant Commissioner Lights gave. As we have already been looking at this chart, the first four slides just kind of give an overview of the rest of the entire department, how we do all the great work that Commissioner Lights just outlined. Basically, as he said, only 14% of our funding is general fund. The rest we leverage from other sources. And so we have thought that we have been very cost-effective in terms of delivering public health services to the citizens of Minnesota by leveraging these additional resources from outside the general state tax dollars. And then, as Keith said also, about two-thirds of that money goes directly out of the department in the form of grants. The remaining third stays behind for a number of activities, which I'll go into detail about. But first, I just want to show you another breakdown of the department. We divided into four program areas. This is where our $1 billion in biennial budget go over the next 2 years. You can see that almost half goes to the community and family health promotion program area, which includes the WIC program, for example. That's our largest. Our next largest is policy, quality, and compliance, at $286 million. Health protection, which includes infectious disease, environmental health, the laboratory, comes in at $176 million. And then about $68 million goes to support administrative support services in the department.
Representative Abler,
same question. I just thought it might be helpful at the beginning to ask this. I don't know what happened to that allotment. Can you just mention anything about that as you go along that's germane to your discussion, if it's been decided or unallotted or nothing happened, or just as you go along to the presentation? Thank you.
Well, just Mr.
That.
Chair, Representative Abler, real briefly, the department, as we're all state agencies, are asked to identify 10% of their current year general fund non-grant remaining dollars, that's a mouthful, to provide as a recommendation for unallotment to the governor. All the agencies did that, including the Department of Health. For the department, that amounted to $1.7 million out of the current year budget. We provide a plan to the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget around how we would allocate that dollars, but in essence, they're all one-time savings that we looked at either carry forward or salary savings because of the hiring freeze we've been under since last February in this biennium, and probably will not impact the future biennial budget discussion.
Thank you. Mr. Akin, well, just on that point, the MRC money that was cut, do you have 100% of the MRC money, or does DHS have some of that?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. The MRC money is actually part of the DHS budget. It is then transferred to the Department of Human or Department of Health for program administration. And so while we distribute the money to the partners, the money is actually not in our budget initially.
Because there was a large cut in that.
There was.
Representative Anfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two quick questions. The pass-through grant portion of the budget, was that part of the unallotment process? And secondly, are those grants to counties and tribes and community-based organizations based on some kind of formula? Are they in a block grant of sorts? And what are the factors in the formula? And is a local match required?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a lot of questions in there. I'll attempt to break them down for you. First of all, on unallotment, no grant funds were affected. And so it was only operational dollars that stayed in the department. In terms of the grants that go out, most of our grant programs, especially state-appropriated programs, are defined in statute for their purpose. They're appropriated by rider language, and so we give the money out for different purposes in different ways as prescribed by the law. And so I would say that there's a variety of answers to your question. Some programs require match, others do not. Some are prescriptive over who the grantees are. Others are competitive processes. It depends on what the area of interest and what the area of the program is that defines that that matters.
Representative, he might just describe what WIC does for those who don't know. But Representative Anzo, you have a question.
So
WIC is a program that is a big chunk of this budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it fair to conclude then that these are quite prescriptive, categorical slices rather than pots where decisions are made at the local level to serve public health needs? The decisions are basically pretty centralized here in St. Paul rather than in the local community.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a fair assumption, though there is some flexibility allowed at the local level based on local needs and local situations. But to take the Chair's example of WIC, for example, WIC is a national program. It's operated the same way in all 50 states. It's under an umbrella by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And so the way that the program is administered, the goals of the program, the means of which the program delivers its services to affected individuals, is pretty much prescribed and uniform across the country. And so the Department of Health just administers the program here in Minnesota.
And I will say that there's a complicating factor of some of these things, including WIC, are in Karen Clark's committee, and some parts of the Department of Health are in this committee. But I think it's best for him to present it as a whole,
sure,
and so that we understand what the Department of Health does, and then later we'll get to the parts that we control.
Okay. But that's an excellent segue, Mr. Chair. If you'll notice on this slide, this is our general fund for the entire department, the $142 million over the biennium. I would draw your attention in particular to the slice of the pie that is in black, because that is the jurisdiction of this committee. It is the policy, quality, and compliance program area. It's $16 million in general funds. It includes the divisions of health policy, which Assistant Commissioner Lights mentioned, runs our health economics program, our Office of Rural Health, a number of other programs. It also oversees the Division of Compliance Monitoring, which is responsible for licensing and certifying and inspecting our nursing homes and long-term care facilities, HMO regulation, and other activities. So, and then one last piece also about this division's jurisdiction is it also includes the last health reform package bill, which was passed this last session, which includes some other activities, most notably the statewide health improvement program and initiative around healthcare homes, which are not in this program area but elsewhere in the department.
Well, we might dispute that because the all the public health spending money in the state health plan comes out of the Healthcare Access Commission, which is under the jurisdiction of this committee.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if I misspoke. I meant that those two items, which aren't in this program area, are under the jurisdiction.
Yeah, right.
This next slide shows how the funding for the $286 million for this program area is divided up. You can see the $183, the largest chunk, is the MERC program. As I mentioned earlier, that is collected. That is the Minnesota, or the Medical Education and Research program that basically provides subsidies to teaching hospitals and other institutions to promote training of our doctors and our primary care physicians. That money is distributed out through a formula, which has undergone revision in the last few years, but it actually covers most of the corners of the state in terms of its reach. The remaining money, as Assistant Commissioner Lights mentioned, comes from either the general fund, the state government special revenue fund, which is our fee programs. Those are fees that we collect on particularly licensed entities. The miscellaneous special revenue fund, which is just a fund where we're able to pool both federal dollars and state dollars, mostly for long-term care oversight of facilities and nursing homes, the healthcare access fund, and then finally a slice of federal funds.
Just say that the Merck money, almost all of it, not quite all of it, but most of it certainly goes to support residency programs. So it doesn't support the first 4 years of medical school. There's a little bit in the first 4 years, but most of it around the state goes to support residency programs. And they used to be supported a lot more by the federal government, and over the years the federal government has cut back, so the state has had to pick up that burden.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. In this program area as well, a little over two-thirds of the money is sent out in grants of various sorts. I'll provide some detail on that. As well as about half of the general fund also goes out in grants specific. The grants that come out of this program area, the largest of the general fund grants, I should qualify that, is the Rural Hospital Capital Improvement Program. This provides capital improvements to facilities and equipment to maintain operations of small rural hospitals, particularly our safety net hospitals. You can see the next biggest slice is a $2 million grant out of the general fund that was meant to offset some issues to certain hospitals here in the state that lost some funding as part of the recent Merck formula change. That money is not base money. That goes away at the end of this biennium, and so that will not continue. So the third biggest chunk is to community clinics. Those are the clinics that assist low-income populations. They reduce uncompensated care burdens. There's about 15 nonprofit community grantee clinics that that money goes to. The remaining amount of grants, there's a small pilot project that I know the chair is familiar with up in St. Louis County with the healthcare demonstration project. There's some money that goes to the tribes for Indian health, and there's a loan forgiveness and migrant grant program as well in this area.
Representative Murphy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you could just delve just a little deeper into the funding that goes to community clinics and what, if that has, you know, specific direction to the community. What can they spend that money? How about that?
Okay, Assistant Commissioner Light, can you provide more detail on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, hi. The goal of the Community Clinic Grant Program was really to provide funding for clinics who might not otherwise have deep pockets to be able to invest in infrastructure for their clinics. That could be things such as information technology systems, could be things such as just capital improvements to their clinics that are necessary to deliver care. So they were really intended to be focused on ensuring the viability of those clinics by allowing them to make upgrades to their either their billing systems, their clinical information systems, or their infrastructure to stay viable.
And Mr. Chair, just to add, these are very small grants. There's 15 grantees, but there's only $600,000 available for either. So in terms of money that does not go out in grants, you can see the lion's share is spent on health facility licensing and certification. This is a required Medicaid, Medicare activity here in the state. It obviously protects our most vulnerable adults. In addition, we also do health facility case mix review, our state share of that. All this money is leveraged against federal funds and fee funds from the nursing homes and long-term care centers. Make up the lion's share of the work that we do in this area. And then finally, the last big piece is the health policy program, which oversees the different program areas that Assistant Commissioner White mentioned, and I'll mention again in another slide. We also oversee in this, or this committee also oversees the Healthcare Access Fund. $55 million or 72% of that goes out in grants. 21% stays at the department. The largest chunk of that is, though it will not be appropriate until the 10-11 biennium, is the legislation that passed this last session for the statewide health improvement program. There's $45.8 million in grants that will be going out to community health boards and tribes across the state.
Yeah. Most of the healthcare access fund money goes to support Minnesota Care, but there are some other things that Mr. Aiken was talking about now that that are in this committee and what are part of the Department of Health. But most of the money spent in the Healthcare Access Fund is for Minnesota Care, which is Department of Human Services. Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that briefly. This is one area where we are definitely partnering with local entities who are going to have the ability to use these grants, hopefully, particularly the public health grants, to leverage and to help local initiatives, grassroots initiatives. So it's not top-down at all. It's really bottoms-up with the state partnering.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since we know that the Healthcare Access Fund is funded by people who actually get sick and need services, we have to be so careful of it. I'm just wondering if you can tell us, just give us an example of the state health improvement program that that we heard was from the bottom up. Can you give us just a couple of samples of what that might be?
Well, actually, we have our statewide, well, we don't have our statewide health improvement program coordinator with us. You know, I would say that, you know, we'll also talk about in the health reform overview, but really quickly, Mr. Chair, Representative, I would just say that, you know, I think that Assistant Commissioner Weitz was very effective in pointing out the epidemic of obesity that's rising both here in Minnesota and across the country. This is a program that is based on a proven pilot called Steps to a Healthier U.S., which has proven interventions which we can scientifically document and base the results on in terms of spreading this out to more, make more systems changes in terms of addressing the incidence of obesity and tobacco here in Minnesota. We think that by getting upstream of actually making people healthier will reduce the incidence of people encountering or engaging the healthcare system, and will actually, the goal would be to drive down costs by having a healthier population using health services less often, and then decreasing the cost of healthcare for all of us.
Just as a follow-up, and then when you do this proven intervention and the other techniques that you use in the process, then are you going to be counting numbers and pounds so that we will be able to see as the years go by on a chart like we do see the cost of health care rising?
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely, we would have to do some kind of evaluation, and we have plans in place to do that, to show the effectiveness of this program, and we have no doubt that it will be effective over time.
And it'll probably be discussed later when they do the reform, but the pilot project was done in, I think, five communities in Minnesota, funded by the CDC, and so it was very effective in those five communities. The CDC loved it, and the CDC likes what we're doing with this newer, expanded version of that to a degree that they're supplying some of the staff for us to do that. So, and I will, when we did the healthcare reform, we had East Coast consultants, I hate to say that, but we were trying to save 20% of the money that we would probably be spending in 5 years in healthcare, and about half of the savings we could get came out of public health activities, not out of changing the healthcare system.
And Mr. Chair, I guess my only comment would be that I understand that it's a wonderful thing and it's probably going to prove really good things, and I'm happy for that. I just feel very strongly that if it's so wonderful, every general taxpayer should have been putting money into the kitty rather than just those who get sick. So that's my comment.
Well, Representative Scalzi, I would say that everybody that has health insurance pays for it, whether they're sick or not.
I understand that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to wrap this up, the other big chunk of money that goes out in grants from the Healthcare Access Fund goes to federally qualified health centers. These are FQHCs and FQHC lookalikes operating in Minnesota. They service populations with low incomes, providing mostly rural and smaller and urban healthcare services. And in terms of where the Healthcare Access Fund goes for program administration, you can see that we spread it around against a number of different program areas. The Office of for the Healthcare Transformation is the biggest chunk. That's this initiative that passed this last session. You can see it's $6.1 million for biennium. Healthcare Homes is the other initiative, plus the administration for the Statewide Health Improvement Program. So nearly half of the healthcare access administrative dollars, the bottom half of that pie chart, come from the legislation that was passed this last session. The upper half, health economics, rural health and primary care, the data project initiative, are all different ongoing endeavors that we've had at the department for some time. And finally, the other source of revenue that we get is from our fees. And you can see that we oversee and regulate a number of activities. The State Registrar's Office, we charge for birth and death records. As Assistant Commissioner Light mentioned, we operate that system in conjunction with the State Registrar and protect those important security documents. We also have vulnerable adults and facility licensing and certification. The bottom half of that pie chart is really to oversee our long-term care and nursing home facilities and meet our required oversight and protection of those individuals. We also oversee a number of professional licensing areas, including credentialing occupational therapists, speech language pathologists, audiologists, hearing aid dispensers, interpreters. The final piece of managed care, we also oversee and regulate and do financial audits on the health maintenance organizations and other plans. With that, I think...
Representative Broad's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. You can give it to me later. I don't need it right now. But related to what percent of our population do not have a birth record? Is there any way to know?
What percentage don't have a birth record? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'll be happy to
That'd
find out.
That'd be great.
Out.
Thanks.
And if you could jump back one slide. I missed something there. One more. Yeah, the Data Project Initiative. Could you remind me what that is? Was that part of last year's bill, or?
No, this is part of the health economics, Mr. Chair. This is part of the health economics program.
Oh.
This oversees the collection and management of health data here in the state and compiles it. It provides most of the basis for the work of that unit and to determining kind of what is happening here in Minnesota on the ground.
Thank you. Any other questions before we get to the reform bill? Okay. Thank you. And we get back to Commissioner Lights again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are now going to provide you an update with implementation of the health reform initiatives that were passed this past legislative session. Joining me at the table is Assistant Commissioner Pat Adams, and she and I will sort of share the presentation. I'll provide an update on reforms related to quality measurement, provider peer grouping, the baskets of care initiative that's in the bill, and some of the other miscellaneous items that are in the bill. Assistant Commissioner Adams will give you an update on the Statewide Health Improvement Program, as well as healthcare homes. the health care reform bill that was passed in May of this year contains a number of key elements. As mentioned before, the public health improvement through the statewide health improvement program, a number of improvements to health care coverage and affordability, chronic care management through the implementation and certification of health care homes, payment reform and price and quality transparency, some measures to improve administrative efficiency and the functioning of the healthcare system behind the scenes, as well as healthcare cost measurement. As we've moved into the implementation stage of the bill, the passage of the bill was somewhat coincidental with the department receiving notification that we had received our application to be a member of the Quality Institute, which is co-sponsored by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Commonwealth Fund, was approved, and we pulled together under that grant opportunity some healthcare thought leaders to help us think about creating a framework by which we can measure whether or not we're achieving the goals of the health reforms that were passed. And that group recommended that we adopt the Institute for Healthcare Improvement's triple aim and the goals of, as that vision and framework for implementation. And the goals of the triple aim are to simultaneously improve the health of the population, improve the patient or the consumer's experience in the healthcare system, and to improve the affordability of healthcare. And so we've adopted that as really an overriding vision and framework for knowing whether or not we're achieving the overall goals of our health reform. Commissioner Magnin and Commissioner Ludeman at the Department of Human Services also agreed that under that triple aim framework, we should adopt certain principles to guide our implementation, and they're listed here. That the purpose of the reform is to improve the health of Minnesotans and to redesign care to improve value. That is, to increase the amount of quality that we're getting for the cost that we're putting into the healthcare system. That we have to start with the end in mind and always remain focused on what we want to accomplish and what success looks like. These reforms should be integrated. They should be driving towards a common goal of accomplishing the triple aim, and we need to keep that end in mind in everything that we do in implementation. To ensure that all Minnesotans benefit from the reforms, we have to aim for market-wide implementation of these reforms. This isn't just about doing things for the Medicaid program differently. This is about the entire market being aligned so that we do get fundamental and transformative change in the healthcare system, and that we're going to seek and expect unprecedented collaboration among both entities within the public sector but also with our private partners as we implement the comprehensive reform initiative. This is an overview of the topics that we'll be talking about. I'll start by talking about the quality incentive payment system, move on to talk a little bit about provider peer grouping and baskets of care, give you an update on some other activities that were in the bill, and then turn it over to Commissioner Adams to talk about the statewide health improvement program and healthcare homes. The first area, Mr. Chair, that I will discuss is the quality incentive payment system. The law requires the department to develop a standardized set of measures by which to assess the quality of healthcare services offered by providers, with an emphasis on outcome measures rather than process measures. And it also then requires us to develop a system of quality incentive payments to reward those providers who are doing well against targets and who are showing improvements in quality of care over time. These requirements are codified in statutes 62U.02. And in terms of our implementation, we have contracted with local organizations, as the bill authorizes and requires us to do, to implement the quality incentive payment system. The lead contract entity on this effort is Minnesota Community Measurements. They've been operating for a number of years in Minnesota on looking at measurement of quality at the provider level. And they are in a collaborative effort under that contract with the Minnesota Hospital Association, the Minnesota Medical Association, Stratus Health, and the University of Minnesota. The contract that was awarded is a $3 million contract over 4 years.
Yes, just for some members that might not know, the Minnesota Community Measurement is the organization that puts together that data that you read in the newspaper that compares your clinic with somebody else's.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
While we're interrupting, just thinking about money, is there money in the forecast taken for savings in the state employee insurance planned for this, you know?
Mr. Chair, not that I'm aware of, Representative Abler.
We were unable to persuade George Hoffman to do that.
There are a number of tasks, Mr. Chair, that the contractor that will be conducting under the Quality Incentive Payment System implementation. Task number one will be to identify and document those quality measures that are being used currently or could be used for public reporting. The second is to develop an incentive payment system. And the third would be to then collect and publicly report those standardized quality measures. I think it's important to recognize that the measures here will be standardized across the state so that providers will not be being measured multiple ways by multiple different measuring entities, but rather the goal here is to drive towards a common set of measures so that we are all commonly being measured and providers could focus improvements in care in those areas. Some important dates to keep in mind. The timeline for us as the department to specify the quality measures in the Quality Incentive Payment System is July 1st of 2009. By January 1st of 2010, providers will be submitting those standardized quality measures. And by July of that year, 2010, standardized quality measures will be being reported publicly. The project status on this area is on schedule to meet those statutory timelines. We have met all the key milestones to date. Issuing the RFP, putting a contract in place with community measurement, and so on. Our general timeline is listed as well. We did receive the inventory of quality measures by early December. We've been working with the contractor to hold public meetings around Minnesota with stakeholders to develop recommendations on a set of quality measures for public reporting. So the universe of quality measures has been identified. We've been working with stakeholders in these public meetings to identify what that narrowing down that set to some core key measures. That will be that inventory of existing quality incentive payment and pay for performance systems will be complete by February of 2009. And then we'll be holding public meetings again on that quality incentive payment system over the course of February and March of this year. And then starting in April, we'll be adopting administrative rules to implement the quality measures and the incentive payment system. By July of this year, we'll begin education and training of providers about what the requirements are with regards to data submission. And then starting in January, we'll begin collecting data. January of next year, we'll begin collecting data, publishing our first public report in July of 2010. And then in July of 2010, the state employee group will be using the quality incentive payment system to implement payment incentives for providers under the CGIP program. Second area is provider peer grouping. The requirements in the law that passed is that the department develop a peer grouping system for providers based on a combined measure of that incorporates both provider risk-adjusted cost of care and quality of care. The goal here is to make transparent information transparently available to the public, to providers, to employers, and other purchasers on the relative value of healthcare providers in Minnesota. And it involves a number of elements that I'll talk about. It's the collection of encounter data to actually implement the provider peer grouping, analytical work for provider peer grouping, for peer grouping providers based on the quality and outcome data that comes from the quality incentive payment system work that I just described, as well as the resources that are used to achieve those outcomes and the price of those resources. And we'll be combining those measures up to develop that peer grouping system. A few important dates. By July 1st of 2009, health plans and third-party administrators will begin submitting data under the encounter data system. By January 1st of 2010, we will be responsible for specifying what the peer grouping methodology will be for providers. And then by June of 2010, we will be disseminating the results of the peer grouping to providers in the state. And by September of that year, be publicly publishing the results of that peer grouping for the first time. The work under this section is authorized by Minnesota Statute 62U.04, Subdivision 4. And to conduct the provider peer grouping activities, the law requires us to collect de-identified encounter data from the health plans. We have contracted with the Maine Health Information Center for these data collection activities. They are a private nonprofit organization who is currently under contract with four other states to conduct data collection activities very, very similar to what we'll be doing here in Minnesota. As a status report, that project is also on schedule to meet our statutory timelines. We have met, similar to the quality incentive payment system, all the key milestones to date. And then for the more general timeline, by January, and the contractor will be holding public meetings with stakeholders to develop recommendations on what data elements will be collected under the encounter data system. Starting in February, we'll be adopting administrative rules to collect that data. And then starting in July of 2009, our contractor will begin working with health plans and CPAs to collect encounter data from the health plans in Minnesota.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. I know we have a little time, but just have to ask about the data part. Are you going to go back in time and collect data? Like, I know there's the DHS, and you guys must have like a mountain of data that's been turned into state programs. Is this going to be data starting July 1st of 2009 that's brand new data, or old data you're going to go look back and harvest?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, we'll be, in terms of the data that will be collected, we'll be starting at this point in time and collecting information. We're not going to require the health plans to go back collect 10 years' worth of information, but rather we'll be collecting starting this year and moving forward. The second element of the provider peer grouping really relates to the analytical work of then using that information to develop these efficiency measures that I mentioned earlier. And this is going to be somewhat complex and somewhat complicated work, but we're going to be using a process that's going to be working very closely and very openly and transparently with the community to draw out the best possible thinking on this. So we have a number of key tasks that will be occurring under this analytical work. The first is to issue a request for information on provider peer grouping systems. So what we'll be doing here is issuing an RFI to the community to receive information around, from anyone whose interest is academics, people who've worked with these type of grouping systems in the past, to provide that information to the department around what seems to be working, what seems to not work. We'll then collect and synthesize the available research and data on these systems, and then have a public work group process to discuss the options for peer grouping methodologies. So stakeholders will have an opportunity to respond to the RFI, and then we'll be holding a series of public meetings to discuss those methodologies beginning in the summer of 2009.
Representative Gobble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Mr. Weitz, we probably don't have time today to go into it at length, but at some point I think it would be good to have you speak to how these things are evolving metro area and rest of Minnesota, because there is clearly a difference between how this stuff plays out in rural areas as opposed to metro area. And maybe to be able to speak to that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, you are absolutely right, and that's an absolutely critical point. So a couple things on that. The first is that we are committed as an agency to having this be an extraordinarily transparent process, and that means that not only will we be holding all our meetings, we won't be holding all of our meetings and our outreach merely in the metropolitan seven-county area. We'll be reaching out to rural providers in rural areas of the state to ensure that they're views, concerns, and issues are heard because they're legitimate ones. The second thing that we're very committed to is that no processes that get developed with regards to risk adjustment or other things will be done in a black box, that the models that we use to peer group will be transparent models that people can feel free to look at, feel free to improve, and have access to so they understand exactly what how we built the mousetrap. So we're committed to that process. We're more than happy at any point in time to come back and provide additional information, either directly or to the committee.
Representative Gobble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just perhaps something to think of as we report this stuff back, if we can be conscious about talking about that, how we're applying it rurally, and how would be real helpful, I think. That's a concern that's out there. That's a concern that's out there.
Final area, Mr. Chair, that I'll discuss real briefly is the baskets of care aspect of the bill. The bill requires the department to establish uniform definitions of baskets of care beginning with a minimum of 7 baskets. This is under 62U.05 of the statute. We have contracted with the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, or ICSI, to facilitate a steering committee and a series of work groups that will go about the business of defining those baskets and then defining what goes into those baskets. the steering committee will be and is responsible for identifying the conditions or episodes of care to include in the seven baskets using things such as prevalence, cost of treatment, potential for innovation, ability to implement market-wide as some of the criteria, to identify issues related to implementation, and then provide general oversight for the work groups. The work group's charge will really be underneath the steering committee to identify the healthcare services or outcomes to include for each basket, to identify what the quality measures are for each of those baskets, and then to ensure that we're incorporating patient-directed decision-making into those baskets as is required by the law. The steering committee has met two times. It's co-chaired by Dr. George Isham from Health Partners and Dr. Doug Wood from Mayo, and is made up of members as listed here. The work group membership will be open to all interested parties. We are anticipating work groups of approximately 12 people for each of the seven baskets, so there's an opportunity for the community to participate in that process. The steering committee at its last meeting did identify the seven initial baskets, and they're listed here. Again, they used criteria such as potential for innovation, the ability for the services to cut across settings of care, prevalence of diseases, and that the ease of implementation market-wide. The baskets include baskets of diabetes care, preventive care for both children and adults, asthma care for children, obstetric care, lower back pain, and total knee replacement.
Just to sort of answer Representative Gottwald, if you look at those two heads, you'd think, well, they got Health Partners from Minneapolis and Mayo, but Doug Wood has spent most of his medical career in Mankato, so he has that feeling for it.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that point, we did certainly reach out to the hospital association to ensure rural hospital involvement and also have membership of consumers through the AARP and others who also have wide perspective. In terms of the project status here, again, we're on track to meet our statutory timelines. We have met all of our key milestones to date. Our process lays out here generally as January through April, the steering committee and work groups will be meeting to define the baskets. They've been defined, thanks, Pat, to define the baskets. And then starting in July, we'll be starting our rule writing process of defining those baskets in administrative rule. And then at the same time, our contractor, ISTE, will be beginning outreach efforts to educate providers on the defined baskets of care. Just a note on baskets of care. I think these are voluntary baskets, so providers need not establish them. Payers need not contract for them. However, we're hopeful that the process itself will identify baskets that will actually have market uptake. I think the steering committee went about its work very carefully and very thoughtfully in picking a wide range of within the seven baskets, things that range from things such as a procedure-based thing, such as a knee replacement, through things like diabetic care, which involve multiple settings across types of providers. So, by July of 2009 and then through October, the steering committee and the work groups will develop plans to address things such as quality measures for the baskets and the administrative challenges of actually implementing those baskets in a payment setting.
Representative Ablett.
Thanks, sir. I'm trying to keep them limited. You know me. Just the timeline and the who's setting up the work groups, is that in process right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ablett, it is in process.
And who's deciding who's on a work group?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, two things on that. First of all, the department will be the decision maker with regards to who is on the work groups, but we're including a very open process of getting applications, reaching out. The law requires us to reach out to trade organizations within Minnesota for membership, so we're doing that. We also have a very transparent website, health.state.mn.us/health-reform, that we push out information on a daily basis out of that website whenever anything changes. So if there are opportunities such as membership on work groups, it gets pushed out from that website, and I would encourage anyone who's interested in learning about the health reforms or being a part of them to subscribe to that website so they have that opportunity.
And so is that your department? If I have a question specific, that would be your hat to wear. So I'll just take it offline. Thank you.
Thanks.
I would also say that this is happening in the private sector, and some of you saw the buses all summer with Carol.com on it. And some of the big self-insured companies like General Mills are pushing this very same approach.
Mr. Chair, real briefly, just a couple of things on a couple of other activities that were included in the bill. We have been prioritizing our activities within the department based on the due date of the deliverables, and there's a couple of things in the bill that have a slightly later due date that we will be getting to. The first is the essential benefit requirement, the requirement that the department work to define elements of what might be included in a what an essential benefit set of care might look like. The due dates for that are October of 2009, January of 2010. So the first is a work group that will be formed to look at this issue. They'll be submitting work back to the department in the fall of this coming year, and then we'll be submitting a report back to the legislature by 2010. We anticipate that by late spring or early summer we'll start to form the work groups in this area. And then the second is a uniform claim study. This was really getting at the notion of is there additional work that we can do in addition to what we've already nation-leadingly accomplished with regards to administrative simplification. We have a report back to you by January 2010. Again, we will likely start some work group meetings on this the latter part of this winter or early part of this spring, just to give you an update on where those are at. Those are a little bit further out on the timeline, and so we haven't actually commenced those activities yet.
Okay, Commissioner Adams, we only have about 7 minutes, so if you don't finish, what you're going to tell us is very important, and if you don't finish, we'll have you back later.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. It's good to be with you here today to continue talking about SIP, which you've already initiated that discussion. And again, to remind you, SIP utilizes prevention strategies to address one of the leading causes of our escalating healthcare costs, and that's the cost of treating chronic health conditions. And so SIP will use evidence-based health improvement strategies to work with and across communities in Minnesota to reduce obesity and tobacco use through policy, systems, and environmental changes. And the grants will be awarded to community health boards and tribes competitively beginning July of this year. You have before you in the slide kind of the model that we are using to build SIP, and it really has involved broad community participation. It's based on a socio-ecological model which recognizes that there's a relationship between individual behavior and their environment. Individuals certainly are responsible for maintaining healthy lifestyles, but individual behaviors are also very strongly influenced by the social environment. The most effective strategies in leading us toward healthy behaviors is a combination of efforts at a variety of levels, looking at the individual, the family, the community, and then public policy. We are going to be focusing on four settings: community, schools, worksite, and healthcare, providing potential grantees with a menu of evidence-based interventions that they can select from to tailor to the needs of their communities. And again, they'll be focusing on common risk factors, which include poor nutrition, physical inactivity, and tobacco use and exposure. We'll be employing a rigorous evaluation process and expect significant accountability both by ourselves as well as our local partners who are awarded the grant. This is just the basic structure that we have used to design SHIP to be implemented in July. We have involved between 60 and 100 individuals within our staff as well as the community, inviting them to come and bring their best thoughts and expertise to the table as we have looked at the menu of interventions, looked at evaluation, etc. The work accomplishment so far is that we have completed the development of a menu of interventions, along with a guide that potential grantees can use to consider how they will implement this within the community. And then hand in glove with that, we are working on developing the evaluation plan that is complementary to the intervention strategies that will be used. That evaluation plan is not yet done, but it's under development. And so with that, then, we're looking at both short-term and then longer-term measures to point us to the success we're having in achieving the desired outcomes. We're also working on developing a model for technical assistance to the grantees that will really help to assure consistency across the state as well as assure their success. We think it's very important that we develop consistent messaging and branding for SHIP so that across the state people recognize that we collectively are working on reducing obesity and tobacco prevention. We also are working very hard to try to integrate SHIP within the broader chronic disease efforts that are going on, not only internally within MDH, but also with the Cancer Society, Heart Association, and others. We want to make sure that this is all complementary. We're not duplicating efforts. And we're all pulling toward the same end, which is improved health outcomes.
Yeah, if I could just add, again, the big corporations are doing very similar things for their employees. Mm-hmm. So they also feel that there are money to be saved if we modify people's behavior. And this program is really designed to fit in with that, as a, so that they're not going in different directions.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We expect that the proposal, request for proposals will be released soon, early part of February, and with applications due back in April. So I think I will just let you peruse our achievements here, but we feel that we have done a stellar job, our staff have done a stellar job in getting ready for implementing SHIP in July, and we are definitely on track. I think what I'll do is to move on to healthcare homes. And I bring the regrets of Dr. Jeff Schiff, who cannot be with us today. This is definitely an interagency effort in terms of developing the healthcare home. Interagency meaning Department of Human Services and the Department of Health. And the model for healthcare homes is the model of delivering primary care in a comprehensive, coordinated, and culturally effective manner. The model is very patient-centered. The patient and the family are actively involved in the decision-making about their health care, and the legislation directs us to initially target persons who have or are at risk of developing chronic health conditions. Our tasks that we've been charged with are to develop criteria for healthcare providers to participate as a healthcare home, to develop a verification process for that certification, develop a common payment methodology, to incorporate a quality improvement process through learning collaboratives, and then obviously to have a method that we can measure the results, both, again, process measures as well as outcome measures. I'd like to highlight some of the assumptions that we have worked from in the development of healthcare home. We have not started from scratch. There's been a lot that's been done locally as well as nationally on healthcare home. And so we have really pulled together those resources to inform us as we are moving ahead with our public and private partners in developing this healthcare home model. Collaboration has been the name of the game, and we have had hundreds of people involved with us in designing healthcare home over the last few months. We believe that flexibility will be prime. Once the model is rolled out, we need to test that model and offer providers and clinics opportunities to tailor that model to their community and to their own practice. Meaningful measures are going to be very important to focus on the desired outcomes over time. And again, we expect that we'll be refining this model as we learn from the experiences of others. This is collaboratively organized within our two state agencies. We're using a combination of grants that we are releasing through our RFP process as well as some state organized processes particularly around the criteria development. We are definitely making sure that this healthcare home model is being integrated within the overall healthcare reform efforts. Our current work, we have been developing outcomes. As our commissioners say, you know, what's the end in mind and where are we shooting? And so we have worked with ICSI to develop outcomes, and we are currently winding up a process we're currently implementing a process for measuring the capacity of our providers to implement healthcare home within the state as well as our consumers, to be able to voluntarily enroll in healthcare homes. They need to know what this benefit is.
If you could wrap it up in a couple minutes, maybe 2 minutes.
Okay.
We have another committee coming in here in 10 minutes.
So our timeline is we are on time. We expect to have our criteria ready to go to an expedited rulemaking process in February, and with being prepared to be fully implemented in July. So I think with that, I'll wrap up, and if you have other questions, you can contact us.
Have you had any contact with the Staples Clinic Hospital?
We have. I'm not sure if they're actually in our work group, but we're very aware of them, and if we haven't already engaged them, that has been our plan.
Because I visited there, and it's pretty amazing. They've already set up medical homes. They were doing it,
good,
you know, a year ago.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So with that, we're a little bit late, so the meeting is adjourned.